people have never come up to me, especially maybe of Ron, and eagerly asked me to tell them about the age of the universe and what Judaism has to say about it. So I beg your indulgence because this is not something which is exciting to you, but again, if you have problems, go to Peter and complain to him. So the... Peter Vitale, terrific. The tall guy with the beard. So the question of the age of the universe is something which obviously does pose theoretically an issue with Judaism, because it would seem that Judaism maintains that the world is 5,764-65 years old at this point, and we know that there is ample scientific evidence that the world seems to be much older than that, billions and billions of years. And the question is, what exactly do we do with the reconciliation of science and Judaism? Now, there are several different schools of thought in Judaism about how to approach science. One of them, and probably the most dominant one, is that science is a bunch of baloney. Right? There is no, scientists don't know what they're talking about, they have a hidden agenda or not so hidden agenda, and they're out to get us, they want to show us up, and they're making all this stuff up in order to show us up, and therefore we just can ignore them and go along on our merry way.
They're Russians.
That's right. So this is, he's been working that long enough that he picked it up. So this is actually a predominant approach in Judaism, because most people don't really care that much about what the scientists have to say. And in fact, it's pretty satisfying, because it's always good to make fun of people. And scientists are very haughty to begin with. So this is the most fun approach to take. There are several other approaches, however, notwithstanding that. And of course, before we get to other approaches, we have to understand, why is it that this approach should not satisfy the thinking person? And there are several reasons for that, primarily two. One of them is the nature of the evidence itself, that the world is very old. It's pretty good evidence. In other words, the dating systems that they use are pretty reliable, and they've been tested under many conditions, and therefore the odds are that the evidence which they have is correct and accurate, that the world is very old. How it originated might be something else, but how old it is, that seems to be pretty accurate. So, also, there's a more important issue, and this is more theological in nature, which is, why would God make such a test that he would make people have to deny all the results of scientific experimentation and reject everything that their eyes or their senses seem to tell them, and go with blind faith and accept that the world is young? That seems to be a very unfair and very, very difficult test for human beings to pass. And therefore, it seems to me that Hashem would not have given such a test to the majority of human beings and expected them to pass it, because the odds are stacked significantly, especially because scientists do come across as knowing everything. And therefore, it really is not fair, I think, to ask humankind to accept that the world is young when all the evidence points in the other direction. Since there is this evidence, and since it seems that this is would be a test beyond normal human expectations, so what do we do with the fact that there is all this evidence that the world is old? So there are several approaches, besides one rejecting science. There are several other approaches. One of the approaches which was taken early on was the approach of the Netziv. The Netziv said that he didn't actually talk about the age of the universe. That wasn't an issue back in the 1800s when the Netziv was the head of the Lodge in Yeshiva. He died in 1892. But he was dealing with the findings of dinosaur bones and stuff like that. And he said that all these things happened, that we have all sorts of dinosaur bones where they're not appropriate, like mammoths in the Siberia and so on and so forth, because at the time of the Mabul, at the time of the flood, there was a tremendous upheaval. And this upheaval turned the earth not literally upside down, but figuratively speaking. And therefore, things or areas which faced the sun in a certain way before no longer face the sun in the same way. Things, places which were cold became hot, places which were hot became cold. It's interesting because there's a Sfarnu, which is a commentary from the 16th century in the Torah, who says actually, although this goes against the Gemara, but he says it anyway, he says that the world's axis was perpendicular to the sun before the Mabul, right? The axis now is on an angle, right? Prior to the Mabul, prior to the flood, it was perpendicular, so there were no seasons because everything was constantly the same distance from the sun, no matter which side of the orbit it was on. Only when the Mabul came and the earth then was knocked off kilter, then seasons began, and that's why God first begins to speak about seasons after the Mabul, and he promises that seasons will continue forever. This is against an explicit Gemara, which is why I have difficulty with this. One of the reasons I have difficulty with this is because the Gemara says that Adam, I mentioned this on Shabbos, for those of you who are here for Shabbos, Adam experienced the days getting shorter after he was created. And he thought the world was coming to an end because his creator was Rosh Hashanah time, and the days got shorter and shorter as time went by. And he made a Yom Tov, he made a holiday on December 25th when he saw that the days started getting longer again. And that's the origin of the holiday of December 25th. So, no, the winter solstice is on the 20th, that's the point. On the 20th or the 21st, he saw that that was the shortest day of the year. And then he made the holiday when he saw that the day started getting longer again. He was able to return it on the 25th. So that's the case. Days don't get longer and shorter unless you have seasons. Unless there's the sun goes, or the earth goes around the sun at a different angle each day, thus changing the attitude of the sun towards the earth. Yeah?
But the seasons happen not because of the angle of the earth, but because it actually gets farther from the sun, because the rotation
isn't
oval shape.
Yeah, but it's because the reason why the southern hemisphere has summer, we have winter, is because of the angle.
Yeah, I know. But I'm saying the axis of the earth doesn't create the that's not where the seasons come from. The seasons come from the distance from the sun.
No,
not what they call me in eighth grade.
The axis creates the northern and southern hemispheres, which is why the seasons are opposite. They
what they taught me in elementary school.
Exactly.
I had a good geography teacher in eighth grade. He taught me that as to the angle of how the sun hits the earth. So
I have a minor astronomy.
Not really. No. It's the angle which the light which the sun.
You can draw that from
the
distance is very small in the oval.
Okay.
Not much of an oval.
Okay, so the according to Sfarnu, there shouldn't have been seasons prior to the Mabul, and yet we see that obviously days got longer and shorter prior to the flood. Yeah. Why not? It was a major holiday, December 25th. Everybody knew. The Romans took it up, became very popular. It says the Gemara gives a whole elaborate discussion of how they used to celebrate this holiday, and they used to take out some mask which represented Adam. You know, the Romans used to do it. So it's an old holiday. Everybody here celebrated it, you know. But before, you think the mask commercialization started recently? old tradition. Yeah.
Why do we think the earth is so young?
What?
Why do we think the earth is so young?
Why do we think the earth is so young? I didn't say it was so young.
Well, compared to what they think.
I haven't gotten there. Well, one explanation we've given so far is that the flood made the earth seem much older. That's what I was about to say, actually. Which is, in other words, since the flood has such earth-shattering, literally, repercussions, so therefore, the earth processes which should have taken billions of years were telescoped into a very short interval of time. And that's why things dating indicates that the world is very old, because the processes were distorted during the Mabul. So that's one approach which is out there in Judaism, and I don't like this approach, because getting back to my text theory, meaning that God doesn't give texts which are too difficult, they have tried to slow down the rate of decay of these radioactive substances, speed it up, done all sorts of things, done extreme laboratory conditions, and the rate of decay has remained constant. And that, which is the way they measure the age of the universe, the age of the world, the relative amount of the radioactive material versus the non-radioactive material. There's several ways of doing it. So they haven't been able to change the rate of decay over time and make it quicker or slower to any significant extent at least. And therefore, it's again asking a person to take a very large leap of faith to assume that some unique, extraordinary condition existed at the time of the flood which would have caused that to happen.
Also, attempting to reduce the rate of radioactive decay would be the same thing as making gravity go up. But it's the same question.
It's that difficult.
It's that fundamental. Uh-huh. It's a weak nuclear force. But also, there's all this astronomical, and it also doesn't cover the astronomical evidence of leakage.
Right, it wouldn't cover that. Yeah. Now, I want to clarify something before I go on, which is all this has to do with scientific proof of the age of the universe. This has nothing to do with evolution. Evolution is a completely separate issue. Whether evolution took place or not is independent of the question of the age of the universe. It may well be that evolution requires the world to be very old, but that doesn't mean evolution ever happened. There's no evidence that evolution ever happened. We've never seen anything evolve. We don't have any way of predicting evolution occurring and of testing it. What happens in a laboratory is microevolution. Fruit flies change somewhat, but fruit flies don't become house flies. So that type of evolution has never been demonstrated. It's not the same thing as the scientific evidence for the age of the universe. Again, evolution is a hypothesis which has never been tested, has no scientific validity. That's why hard scientists look down on biologists, because they don't really have any true science, right? The question of the age of the universe is a much more basic question because it's based on significant scientific principles that have been tried and tested. So that's one approach, the approach of the Mabul. Another approach which is taken is the approach of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Those of you who have, how many people here have connection to Lubavitch?
Well, I go to Lubavitch.
Okay. So if you ask the Lubavitcher how to deal with the age of the universe, they will always give you the same answer because it's the Rebbe's answer. Now, the Rebbe didn't make it up. It existed before the Rebbe, but the Rebbe said, this is the real answer, and therefore, in Lubavitch, no matter how elegantly they may seem to present it, it's not because they explored the other options and rejected them, but rather because the Rebbe said it, and therefore, the Rebbe said it must be true. And that's, the fact that the Rebbe said it doesn't mean it's not true also. It's important to know. So what the Rebbe said is, like as follows. The Chumash says, or rather the Talmud says, that everything which is created was created fully grown. Meaning that the first day of creation, whenever that was, there were giant redwood trees in California. Now, giant redwood trees have rings inside them. And the rings indicate how old they are, right? So therefore, those redwood trees, which are massive and big and fully developed on first day creation, they must have had rings. And the rings would have indicated that that tree had been there previously. And that tree had been there for hundreds and thousands of years previously. Yes, obviously it was on that very day. So Lubavitcher Rebbe said, just like the tree has a history built in, because it was created fully formed as a mature tree, so too the world has a history built in, because the world was created as a fully formed, mature world. And therefore, if there's fossil fuel in the world, there have to be fossils. It's true those fossils never lived, but that's part and parcel of the tree logic. Just like if there was a tree has to have rings, a human being such as Adam was created as if he was a fully grown man, so to have fully grown petroleum, you have to have fossils, which are the precursor and therefore like the rings of the tree, which exist, which indicate that there was existence prior, but in fact it's not the case. The world was created mature, therefore it's created to look as if it was several billion years old. Now, the great genius of this proof is that you can't disprove it. There's no way you can say, prove that the world wasn't created old, right? How can you go and prove that? And in fact, there's no way I could prove to you, this is up there, probably is, but just maybe it's facetious, like Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan said, perhaps the entire world was created 5 minutes ago, or less. And each one of us is created with memories. You know, God could do anything. He can create us with intact memories, and maybe he created all of history and all memory, and we just, 5 minutes ago, and we really didn't exist prior to that. We just came into being 5 minutes ago. What?
You never walked into the door, just imagine.
No, we all remember me walking into the door, even though it actually didn't happen, right? So
it's sort of like we say that Hashem recreates the universe every millisecond.
Uh-huh.
So really, 5 minutes ago, it doesn't exist. It didn't exist.
Right, it's a renewed, new creation every moment. So therefore, you can assume that it would just be end quite recently. And then it requires an act of recreation. God constantly sustains the universe, so therefore, maybe he sustains it, and maybe he started sustaining it not 6,000 some odd years ago, but, you know, he started sustaining it 5 minutes ago. Yeah?
Is the ancient universe, I guess, the idea that maybe this was the world created?
We're getting there.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. I can't say the real answer because who knows, but to look for the best answer, we go back to Chazal, we go back to the Midrashim, and we go back to the sources which speak about the issue of how old the universe is. And it's important to note that there are sources in the rabbinic literature which predate all the challenges which came about in the 19th century by hundreds and even thousands of years. It's not something, the age of the universe is not something which became a question all of a sudden towards the end of the 19th century or middle of the 19th century, but rather this has been an issue which has been dealt with previously, even at a time when there was no need to do so because the faith was being challenged. The rabbis deal with it in several places as a matter of fact. And they say that there is a Gemara, for example, which says that God builds worlds and destroys them. Now that Gemara can be taken in two ways, and it was a matter of dispute between the Kabbalists. Some Kabbalists took that Gemara to be literal and meant that God creates worlds and destroys them, and we will follow that path in a few moments. Other Kabbalists, chief among them Zari, it holds that it's not to be taken literally. It means that God created spiritual worlds, or maybe it can be taken literally, but on the spiritual level. God creates spiritual worlds and destroys them. He doesn't create physical worlds and destroy them. He creates spiritual worlds, constantly renews, destroys, and so on and so forth. That is Zari's house approach, and you have to understand how influential Zari, who lived in the 16th century in Tzfat, was, that almost all contemporary Kabbalah is based on what Zari said. And the Kabbalists who lived and flourished prior to Zari are almost completely ignored in Kabbalistic circles. Zari was held to be a great revelation and a legitimate original source for all sorts of Kabbalistic ideas, and he was held to be superior in that respect to many generations before him. So therefore, Zari came and said, there's only one world, or what, two worlds, this world and the world to come. And the world is only 5,000 some odd years old, so then that has a lot of influence over the Kabbalistic and, by extension, the Hasidic world. Which is why, to a large extent, they have no choice but either to say, like the Lubavitcher Rebbe, that the world was created old, or to dismiss science, like we talked about previously. Because the assumption, the starting point, is that Zari must be correct. That is the a priori assumption which a Kabbalist or a Hasid is going to make. Okay, that's an important thing to know about Judaism. That the Hasidim are very big on the Ari. In fact, when the first Lubavitcher Rebbe put together his own nusach, his own version of davening, even though he put it together, he called it nusach Ari. Right? It's not the Ari's nusach. The Ari davened like the real Spider daven. But what?
He
didn't mean Hatzfaradim. Now what's called nusach Tzfar today? What's called Nusach Tzfar today is the Nusach of the Hasidim. What the Sfaradim call is either Minhag Sfaradim or Egot HaMizrach, in order to distinguish it as being pure Sephardi. So there, Zari, even though he was an Ashkenazi Jew, nevertheless he davened according like the Sephardim davened. So, but since Zari was since Zari is such a primary source, so therefore the Baal HaTanya, when he wrote a Siddur, called it the Nusach Ari, and he adapted certain parts from the Ari. But we actually in this room, since none of you look Hasidish to me, so therefore, although who knows, but we are not beholden. Those of you clean shaven surely don't fit the bill. We are not beholden to the Ari, and therefore we can go back in time and speak about other sources and deal with them and use them in our quest. And there's another source in the Medrash which says that there were 974 generations of human beings prior to the existence of this world, and they were evil, and God swept them away in His wrath. How do we know that? Because it says about the Torah, "Davar tibal elef dor." It was a word which was commanded at the end of 1,000 generations. And the Medrash adds, I don't understand. There are only 26 generations from the time the world was created till the Torah was given at Mount Sinai. 1,000 minus 26 leaves 974. Where are the other 974 generations? Oh, says the Medrash. They existed in a prior cycle of the world. And there is a sefer called the Tiferet Yisrael. The Tiferet Yisrael is a book, a commentary on the Mishnah. And in his commentary on the Mishnah, at the end of his commentary on the order of Nezikin, which is one of the six orders of Mishnahs, he has a long discussion about the soul, the afterlife, and the age of the universe. And in this discussion, the Tiferet Yisrael continues and expands on this idea, which is an idea which has a Medrash behind it and has many Kabbalistic sources behind it before the Ari, including Rabbeinu Bechayai, and even after the Ari, a few, like the Rebbe Kachrin of Lublin. And he says that this is not the first cycle of the world. He says this is the fourth cycle of the world's existence. Now, before we go further, you have to know that true to form, for many years, Hasidim, until this day probably, for all I know, Hasidim refused to learn the Tiferet Yisrael. Because this statement which he made runs counter to the Ari. And therefore, he clearly is
wrong.
Right. Heretic. So therefore, now that they have not learned this part of the Tiferet Yisrael, they decide, you know, let's stay away, and they would not learn any of it. And certain editions of Mishnayos, they just ripped out this section, which discussed this issue in order to make sure that nobody ever came across it. But the Tiferet Yisrael there says that there are the different cycles of the world, and he says that we're in the fourth. And he says, you know, I give you a little bit of evidence that we're in the fourth, because on the fourth day of creation, the sun and the moon were created. And we are the first cycle station which received the Torah. And the Torah is like a luminary, right? There's the spiritual, physical luminaries, which are the sun and the moon, and then the spiritual luminaries, which is the Torah, and that was given in this cycle for the first time. The previous cycles did not have the Torah. And the third cycle goes on, he says, he obviously had a tremendous scientific knowledge. He lived in the early 1800s, 1830s, and he writes a tremendous amount about fossils and about dinosaurs and megalosauruses and mammoths. You might have some. Is some quoted in there in the booklet?
Yeah.
And
paraphrase.
What?
Paraphrase.
And he says about these things. Look, all these fossils prove that the rabbis were right, because the rabbi said that the world was here in previous cycles, and only by saying the world was here in previous cycles can we explain why you find fossils which are more suitable for Africa in the middle of Siberia. It clearly indicates that in the cataclysmic period between worlds, things were overturned, tossed over, and therefore you find things where you wouldn't find them today. And he says, besides that, the very fact that these wondrous creatures exist deep down in the earth indicates that there were previous cycles, and we have cycle upon cycle built into the world. Yes? Really? What does the first pasuk of Bereishit say? Yeah. What does that mean? Not according to Rashi. Rashi says that that first pasuk, "Gracious Baruch Hu, the Shemayim Varech Baruch Hu, Yisrael Tov Lo," means in the beginning of God's creation of heaven and earth, the land was desperate and there was water. He says explicitly, Rashi, the Torah doesn't tell us when the water and the earth were created. It's a Rashi! A Rashi on Chumash! Right?
I don't realize that.
Yes. Most people don't realize that because you tend to glance over Rashi when you look at it.
Can you say that a little slower again? Right? What were Rashi's sources on that?
I don't know. Rashi is for but Rashi was a big man. He knew what of what he was speaking.
Did I come to one point that Rashi said that Ramban was challenging Rashi's...
If Rashi didn't know what he was saying, it wouldn't be worth the Ramban's time to challenge him. Yeah. Don't say that all Jews are intellectually honest. Right. Yes. But there are many intellectually honest Jews, but there are many people who are not intellectually honest. And that's the way it is. Yeah.
So they explain the Tohu Bohu as the destruction of previous worlds.
Yes. That's one way. By the way, there's several ways to approach the beginning of Chumash. I'll describe them in a few moments. But I once saw in a safe I have at home, that he said, I don't know where, by a great rabbi named Rabbi Nachum Kasher, whose books are in the yeshiva somewhere, and he says that Tohu and Bohu are subatomic particles. That the world before it was created was full of all these subatomic particles. This is just off on a tangent. And God took all these Tohu and Bohu, these subatomic particles, and he formed the world from them. Okay, yeah.
Does that mean that Mashiach would come at the seventh world?
No, Mashiach will come in this cycle. So this cycle is Thomas Mashiach. There might be a Mashiach in the next cycle too. In other words, each cycle has its own culmination, whatever that culmination is, either good or bad. Excuse me? Yeah, according to the very so three more times. Yeah. So
it's not. Then
it's Olam Haba. Then there is the real Olam Haba, meaning the eternal world. The last cycle is the eternal one. But
when you pass away, your soul is still hanging out for three cycles?
It depends. It could be that there is... my assumption, although I haven't seen this brought down anywhere, is that the same souls get recycled over again. In other words, the idea is there's ever a progress by the same soul towards perfection as time goes by. And you come down... and that's why... You know, this is something which you see also in the world of technology, which is that what is the main way in which technology advances? By making things smaller and more powerful and elegant, right? And the same thing you see in creation. First, the creatures were much larger and much coarser. And over time, things became smaller and more compact, more complex, you know, kind of like integrated circuits.
You can't say about God that God becomes perfected. God is perfect.
No, God is perfect, but the world goes through a process of perfection. Everything in this world goes through a process like that, right? Things change, hopefully, I shouldn't say everything, because the things strive towards chaos, but human beings specifically, hopefully they go through life trying to perfect themselves, right? And there's a message. The message is that perfection is not a one-time thing. You don't reach it and automatically, but rather something which you have to work at and to recreate and redo. The world was not created for God, right? I mean, God wanted it there, but the world was created in order to allow for the perfection of entities which should resemble God. Right? Yeah?
Now that we're getting to this final seventh level of Olam Haba, everybody's just going to sit back and just hang out?
You see, it's hard for us to understand this because we think that one of fun is going to Disney World. But the actually real fun is to have a connection to Hashem and be nehaneh to enjoy the radiance of the divine presence.
What about Hashem? He's just going to sit around and that's it?
You're going to hang around with us.
I don't exist anymore.
Yeah. You're going to hang around with us. It'll be cool. Don't worry. Yeah.
So, I'm not sure if you said this already, but so what happens to this physical world right here when it ends?
That's a very, very big machlokas, the dispute between the Rambam, Maimonides, and everybody else. The Rambam holds that eventually all Maimonides, holds that eventually all real matter ceases to exist.
It disappears.
Disappears. And then everything exists in a world of spirit, including human souls. According to almost every other Jewish source, you have to understand something about Maimonides. He was so strong is not the right word, but he was so authoritative that he can take on everybody else. And by definition, what he held becomes a legitimate position. In this case, he did take on everybody else. And everybody else maintains that Olam Haba, the world to come, is actually a physical world which takes place on planet Earth. In other words, the world itself, just like was recreated between the previous cycles, gets recreated again after the final, and in the final cycle is this world continues to exist. I don't know, this world, other planets as well, but in any event, it is a physical place, not a spiritual place.
So either way, the scientists do that, the sun's going to burn out, and then the earth is going to freeze. That can't be true.
I have to do lots of things. Who knows? Maybe the sun will burn out. Maybe we'll move to some other planet. But the point is that the question is whether this physical... By the way, there is the last Mishnah in Shas. The last Mishnah in Mishnah is said, and the question is whether you take this literally or not, but the Mishnah says each and every tzaddik in the world to come, which means we think the ultimate world to come, each and every tzaddik will get 310 worlds. Now, most people take this, not literally, it's figuratively, that 310 worlds. 310 in Hebrew means yesh. Yesh means something which exists, the true existence, and these are spiritual realms, which are the true existence of tzaddikim, of righteous people, but it's entirely possible that it's literal. And that just like God created worlds, and that's what God does, so too each and every tzaddik will have their own world to create. In other words, hopefully we'll all be tzaddikim, and we will all get 310 worlds, I assume, because the first few will mess up. So therefore we have to get chances to go and do, like God, to create worlds.
That's great.
I don't know if that's the shot in the Mishnah, but that's about it. I don't know. I'm just thinking.
One of
the
fourth
men.
Who's the fourth man?
Yes.
Can the Jew be said in the verse?
What? No, it doesn't seem that, but that's because historically we would have had evidence that that was the case. It seems not that way because of our Masorah. We have a Masorah from Mount Sinai that's not the case. There was indeed such a theory, even in the time of Chazal, and they quashed it. That's why they changed when they translated the Torah into Greek, the Septuagint, they changed the first pasuk from Bereshit for Elohim, which could be construed as there was a God named Bereshit who created God. To in the beginning, God created something like that. I forget exactly how they changed it. There was such a theory. What?
Elohim
Barabbas Sheik. Okay, thank you. So the yeah.
Oh, sorry.
You actually have something to say?
Yeah, I do. I just thought you were going to continue your comment. Anyway, I've heard that there's an actual distinction between Olam Haba, which is essentially supposed to be like after the resurrection, and what the Rabbi actually calls Olam HaNesham.
According to the Ramban. According to the Ramban, Nachmanides, and everybody else besides the Rambam. According to the Rambam, it's a little bit semantic. According to the Rambam, where you go after you die is Olam Haba. Mm-hmm. Right? According to the Ramban, you go to a very nice hotels, but it's not Olam Haba. You know, some spiritual hotel. I don't know where it's located. But called the Garden of Eden. But the getting back to the idea of the cycle. So the obviously the cycle gives you some leeway, but if each cycle is 7,000 years, like the Kabbalists contend, so it doesn't get you to billions. Could be that in the cataclysmic eras between the worlds, maybe they were longer. But still, we would like to have a source in Chazal which dovetails, in early rabbi Levitic sources, which dovetails with the theory that the world is ancient. And we have one, and Rabbi Kaplan brings it down in this pamphlet we have, he just paraphrases it, but actually in the book which was published, if you read Ron's introduction, you'll see, he actually, the passage was brought down from the 13th century Kabbalist, Rabbi Yitzchak of Akko, who wrote that, he says, I'm going to now divulge a great secret to you. And you shouldn't, I think he said you shouldn't tell anybody else. The question is, what exactly, I guess he felt this should be kept secret. It was kept secret for a few hundred years, but now it's public knowledge, so I wouldn't worry about it if I were you. But he says that in the previous cycle, the days were not days like our days, but they were days like God's days. And as it says in Tehillim, it says, ki elef shanim beinecha ki yomet mo ki avor. 1,000 days in your eyes are like a yesterday which passed. That means that one of those years in the previous cycles was not 365 of our days, but 365,000 years. Each year, each day being a year. I know for all the cycles it was like that, but in the cycle there was, it, at least in some of the cycles, that was the way it worked. How does Rabbi Yitzchak of Akko know that? I don't know. It's a big secret. That's the secret. But the point is, he had no reason to have to write this in the 13th century. Was, as a matter of fact, probably if he would have told people that at that point, last people thought he was wacko. But he did write it, and it does dovetail with science, in that if you multiply that by the amount of worlds that there are, whether they're 4 or 5 or 6, you'll come out to several billion years. So, give or take a billion. That's what comes out to approximately what science holds. Of course, we can't know for sure in any event. But this source of Rabbi Yitzchak of Akko makes the science and Torah dovetail very, very precisely. And again, this is actually looking into sources which exist, and Rabbi Kaplan makes this point. This is looking into sources which exist in order to find the answer from Chazak, from the rabbis and the Kabbalists, as opposed to making something up as you go along. So let it around them, yeah.
So, what was the statement again about Hashem having days that are much longer?
1,000 years. The Pasuk in Dillon says, and this is where Yitzchak of Akko quotes, that the verse in Dillon says that the God's days are 1,000 years.
Okay.
God doesn't really have
days. But God doesn't have days.
Right. But that means that Yitzchak of Akko is telling you that what that verse means to tell us is that days in previous cycles were 1,000 years long. That's the purpose of the verse, according to Yitzchak of Akko. Okay? That's going to teach us. And this is, I want to stress again that evolution has nothing to do with this. In fact, it's interesting, the Malbim, who was a great commentary on the Tanakh and the Bible, written by in the 19th century, he actually took Darwinian evolution and applied it to to the order of the creation of the species. And he said, you see, evolution took place because it went from, not precisely the way Darwin has it, but it went from birds to fish to as the lowest smaller animals to larger animals. So you see that the creation followed the pattern of evolution. That's how it happened. So evolution in and of itself is not a contradiction to Torah, to Judaism. It's only a contradiction if you believe that it happened on its own. And it is preposterous to believe that evolution happened on its own. Even the evolutionists have great difficulty trying to make evolution work on its own by random mutation. It is a very unlikely thing to occur, and again, nobody's ever seen it happen. So therefore, evolution of itself, Darwin was a very religious man. Evolution in of itself is not a contradiction to Judaism. Rather, some people misuse the theory of evolution in order to attack Judaism, but it's mostly usually out of ignorance and lack of understanding. Now, getting back to the Chumash itself. In the Chumash itself, there are two very different ways of looking at the first two chapters in Bereishis. The first two chapters in Genesis, if you went later on to take the Chumash, you'll see. And Rabbi Kaplan goes through it in this pamphlet to a large extent. But the first two chapters seem to duplicate each other. Right? The first chapter sort of talks about creation in 6 days. And then the second chapter also starts talking about how the plants were created and how animals are created and so on and so forth. So there's one school of opinion which holds that the two stories, this is not what Rashi says. Rashi says the second chapter is a detailed unpacking of the things which are written in generalities in the first chapter. But according to some schools of thought, the first chapter in Bereishis describes what happened, millions and billions of years ago when the earth was first created. And then the second chapter in Bereishis jumps to our current creation. So therefore it says that on the sixth day man was created, so that means that man was created way back when. Adam was then created in the second chapter of Bereishis. That's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is if you do take Rashi's approach and say that the second chapter of I'm not finished yet. Sorry. He's one of my biggest fans. If you do take the second chapter as being a detail of the first chapter, so then, like I said before, then the first pasuk itself indicates that there was something around when the earth was created in the cycle, meaning that there was the desolation, the water, and darkness. And it's interesting because, there is a very basic question in the Chumash, which many sources deal with, which is, how could there be light on the first day if there's no sun and moon until the fourth day, right? Because the light, it says, there was light on day one. But all light that we know of is light which comes from the sun and the moon. So I know the sun and moon were not created until day four. So the Chazal already say there was a special light which was created for independent of the sun, and it's safeguarded for the tzaddik and for the world to come. When God created the world, the light of the fourth day, he took that special light, whatever it is, and he put it away for the next world. But another possibility is that what happened was that in the era between the worlds, then the sun and moon were either obscured or there something happened to them. And therefore, on the first day there already was light. But later on the fourth day, actually the sun and the moon became again visible in the sky after they might have been not visible for many, many years. Of course, there's nobody to see them. But the idea was that they had, in those cataclysmic events, something had happened to the sun and the moon, and therefore they had to be restored to appear directly in the sky. Yes. So that's another possibility. And Rabbi Kaplan says an interesting thing. He says that, if the Torah seems to be skipping a bit, the first chapter talks about tens of billions of years ago, and the second chapter skips to this cycle. It says it's not a big deal. We find the Torah does that several times. For example, in Parshas Chukas, in one of the Parshios in Bamidbar, in the book of Bamidbar, the Torah skips 38 years. The Torah skips from the second year after they left Egypt, shortly after the sin of the spies, to the last year in which Miriam died. It skips 38 years. So what's the difference, 38 years or 2 billion years? The Torah only tells us the salient points. It doesn't tell which it has to tell us in order to teach us the story. It's not, in order to teach us its lesson. It's not a history book. The history, Chazal had, the rabbis had, as an oral tradition. Eventually they got written down as the Medrash and as the other sources which we have, the other Talmudic and later sources which we have. The main point is to conclude, is that there is a tendency to assume that religion and science don't work hand in hand. But if you take the right attitude towards science, then science is a very powerful tool for seeing how wondrous God's works are, how extraordinary and amazing are the things that God made, and especially nowadays when we're able to reveal not just, you know, that a tree is beautiful, but the intricate workings of how a tree works and what goes on at the level of a cell and a molecular level. The way one's supposed to look at science is not as a challenge, but rather as the amazing way in which God designed the universe within the... Are you okay? Here I was coming to the climax and you ruined it. The amazing way in which God created the world and let scientists figure it out. And this is the most basic evidence of God, which we speak about. The existence of God, in many things, Judaism has many, so to speak, proofs that God exists. But the most simple and basic proof is the complexity of the world, the extraordinary complexity of everything which exists, far more complex than man has ever been able to make and ever will make. And one should take all aspects of one's life and try and find how they reflect God's ways of working the world. That's it for this evening, folks. By the way, we...